Lay out this incredibly ambitious framework. It's all centered on things like generosity, trust, community design, but applied to physical stuff, to material resources. It's a very idealistic design, aiming to build economies from the bottom up. And they even mention plans for like materialistic top-down AIs, enhancing it later on. Bit futuristic there. So our mission today is pretty clear. We need to quickly get our heads around the five main parts, the scopes of this proposed economy, you know, how things are made, how they're shared. And then we're going to really drill down into the philosophy and honestly the tricky psychological bits of what they call shareful lending.
Yeah, and it's that philosophy starting point that makes it interesting, right? Because the whole structure, if you look at it, it's built on these five core scopes. You've got the acquisition side, mining, which they also call worthing, and manufacture or crowdcrafing.
Okay, mining and manufacture. Got it.
And then come the three service scopes. This is how things actually get passed around. Gift, they call it freed, lending, shareful, and exchange, chain. We'll probably stick to the simpler names, gift, lend, exchange. But it's useful to know they have these more idealistic terms for each one.
Right. So what's the core idea driving all this? What makes it different from, you know, standard economics?
Well, the fundamental belief here is that material things bring more love. That's their term.
Yeah.
And are therefore more valuable when they're ecological, well-made, and crucially, really accessible to the community. Accessibility is key. It's about the flow of things, not just permanent ownership.
That focus on flow, that leads us right into the relationship side of things, doesn't it?
Exactly. Lending, their shareful model, it sits right there in the middle of those service scopes. On one hand, it naturally leans towards gifting, which is, you know, pure generosity.
Yeah.
But, and this is the practical bit, if you actually want to meet the community's long-term material needs sustainably, lending realistically has to lean towards exchanges sometimes. So it's constantly trying to balance being perfectly generous with being, well, materially sustainable.
Because if you just give everything away, eventually there's nothing left to give.
Yeah.
Makes total sense. Okay, let's zoom in on that middle ground then. Shareful lending. The sources describe it as trying to create a sort of creative commons, but for physical objects.
Yeah.
Complete with like scalable clauses. They thought a big library of contracts was the way to go initially.
They did, yeah. They built these website prototypes and they had all these optional clauses lenders could pick from. The idea was that this technical kind of legal framework would build confidence quickly.
But what happened? What did they learn when they actually tried to implement it?
The big lesson, the hard lesson, was that the real bottleneck wasn't legal complexity. It was just basic social trust. They realized the most important thing to work on is cultivating what they call unmaterial relational affinities. Basically, deep trust between the people borrowing and lending. That turned out to be way more critical than just adding more and more legal clauses for the lender to sort through.
Interesting. So what stops us from lending more? What are those psychological barriers?
Well, they flag two big ones. First, it's really hard for us to calculate our own future needs, our sustainability. And you worry, like, what if I lend this out and then I need it in 6 months? That fear of regret.
Right. Yeah. I've definitely felt that.
And second, lending creates this, they call it a midterm relationship projection.
Okay, what does that mean?
It means if I lend you something useful, say a power tool, you might subconsciously start seeing me as a source for future resources. You might attach yourself to me in a way I, the lender, didn't sign up for and maybe don't want to sustain.
Wow, that's a deep insight. So you're not just lending the object, you're kind of implicitly setting up a potential future obligation or connection. That's a lot of emotional weight.
It really is. And the sources go further, describing lending as a real-time trust test. It's a way of seeing how they care about us, with the item being the stand-in, the metric. Think about lending, like your favorite book or jacket. You worry about getting it back, sure, but also how they treat it, because it feels like a closer extension of our own body.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the platform suggests that the ultimate motivation, maybe a bit self-centered but powerful, is boiled down to, I want to lend it to anyone that would love me a bit more because of that.
So it's driven more by wanting that connection, that affinity, than needing ironclad legal protection. But okay, if you're relying on trust, how do you give any security without making the lender seem? Well, the source says, picky or over-paranoid. That jump from big psychology ideas to tiny contract details feels like a problem.
It is a huge problem, and it forced them to completely rethink how the interface should work. They realized that making the lender choose from a long list of universal clauses just increases their anxiety. So the new approach, the preferred one, is actually for the system to suggest custom borrowing messages or conditions to the requester, the borrower. And these suggestions are based on the platform's understanding of their existing relationship.
Ah, so the platform steps in like a mediator,
yeah,
suggesting the terms for the borrower to propose.
Exactly. And this is like a really clever design choice. The requester proposes the terms the system suggested. Then if those conditions cause any awkwardness or friction,
yeah,
the requester can mentally blame the suggester, which is communitarian code.
Wait, hang on. Communitarian code, what's that?
It's just their internal phrase for the platform's algorithms, the system itself, the community rules embedded in the code. So if the system suggests, say, requiring an ID check and the lender agrees, the borrower can feel like, hey, it wasn't me being difficult. The system made me ask for this. It lets the platform absorb the social awkwardness.
Huh. That shifts the blame.
It saves space for both people and reduces the feeling that the individual lender is being untrusting or demanding.
That's a neat psychological trick.
Yeah.
But isn't there a risk? If the system takes the blame, does the requester feel less responsible for potentially difficult conditions they accepted?
That's the balancing act, definitely. They're betting that the overall positive experience of successful sharing outweighs that minor friction. And to make it work, they group these suggested clauses into four main types.
Okay, what are they?
First is destination. Who gets to use it? That could range from close, like family, to granted users who might need ID or good reviews, all the way to anyone. Second, purposes. Why are you borrowing it? There's even an option called improvement where the borrower basically promises, I'll return it better than I got it, or just anything.
Okay, destination, purpose.
Mm-hmm.
What about the practical stuff?
Right. Third is contribution. This isn't about making money. It's about covering costs to keep things sustainable. Like, one option is lend me, which signals the borrower is willing to lend something back in the future, or patrimonial contribution, which is just, you know, covering the direct costs, like paying for the gas you used in a shared car.
Makes sense. And the last one.
Finally, time space. This covers when and where. Could be simple, like use it with me, or really flexible, like return when I ask for it. No fixed deadline up front, but you promise to keep it safe and give it back promptly when needed.
This flexibility seems key. And it brings us to another really important distinction they make. Binding clauses versus non-binding wishes.
Yes. And this is where they try to decentralize things. Move away from relying purely on formal enforcement, violating a binding clause. That could mean going to court or facing some kind of community penalty enforced through the platform's tools.
Okay, standard enough. But the wishes?
Violating a non-binding wish, well, that only results in karmic compensation.
Karmic compensation sounds very low. How does that actually work on the platform?
It's basically just social consequences, reputation damage. If a lender had a wish, say, they wished the borrowed item was used for a community project and you used it for something else, they can't sue you. But they might feel the wish wasn't respected and they might just decide, okay, I'm not lending to that person again. Your informal score goes down. Future lenders might see that or just hear about it and be less willing to share with you.
Ah, so it's reputation management.
Exactly. The idea is to use these wishes to decentralize more the need of shareful bindingness and law itself. They're betting heavily on social pressure and reputation over formal contracts.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly. We've spent a lot of time on lending. What about the other service scopes they mentioned? Let's start with freed gifting. Gifts are supposed to be free of obligation, right? But the sources seem to admit it's not quite that simple.
Yeah, that expectation is almost impossible to escape completely. Even with a gift, the giver usually holds some level of hope for an unmaterial respect demand, like hoping you appreciate it. And often, maybe subconsciously, a more concrete future material gifting back. The freed model tries to address this head on. It offers these pre-written declarations where you explicitly waive your property rights. But interestingly, you can still attach non-binding wishes about how you hope the item will be used in the future.
But doesn't formal law sometimes get in the way here, especially with big physical gifts?
Oh, absolutely. That's a major hurdle, the source points out, for things like land or buildings. Even if you try to gift it to the community with a wish, like, I wish this always remains a public park, the legal system might step in, transfer the formal rights, and potentially ignore or override that wish. Bureaucracy can get in the way of truly putting material things into a public domain managed by wishes.
Right, the legal system isn't really built for wishes. Okay, what about the third service scope, chain exchange? How do you handle exchanges in an economy that's supposedly about generosity, not profit?
Their answer is something called flovins.
Flovins, okay.
Yeah. They define flovins as a non-fungible merit currency. Think of it like reputation points you earn, but they can function a bit like currency. You get them based on your activity stats and for doing lovelier actions like helping maintain a shared resource or being a consistently good borrower.
Non-fungible. So each Flovan is unique, like an NFT, not like dollars where each one is the same.
Kind of, yeah. But the interesting part is that these Flovans can then be converted into something called Flow Hours, which are fungible, like regular time or money. But even then, there's a catch. These Flow Hours can be restricted. For example, you might have essential hours versus other types. So maybe a Flovan you earn doing something non-essential can only be exchanged for someone else's non-essential time. It creates this tiered value system, trying to link merit directly to the type of activity.
Wow, that's a lot of layers just to manage value exchange while trying to keep it lovely. Okay, so we've covered how things move around gift, lend, exchange. But what about where they come from in the first place? How does Flov imagine making things?
That brings us to their crowdcrafting model. The name kind of gives it away. Think open source principles, but applied to making physical goods. It's designed for open, decentralized manufacturing. Anyone can contribute maybe some design work, maybe a bit of assembly labor, and they get planned rewards, basically shares, based on their contribution when the final item is finished and distributed or maybe sold using Flovans within the system.
So breaking down production into smaller rewarded chunks.
Exactly. It lets lots of people participate at different stages.
Now, these community projects, crowdcrafting and others, they must rely a lot on people getting together, right? They mentioned forking parties and project gatherings. But the sources say these events often don't work very well. What's the problem?
Yeah, this seems to be a major pain point. It's about engagement quality. The people running the projects, the maintainers, they pour tons of love and energy in, but they feel like they just can't get enough skilled help. When they hold these big general gatherings, often the attendees are just passive. They get overloaded with information, maybe give some superficial feedback, or are just there to be seen, you know, show off a bit.
Been to conferences like that.
Right. So the actual return on investment for the maintainers in terms of getting real help is often really low.
So what's the fix? How do they make these gatherings more productive and less performative?
They suggest making the standards for these events much more active, much livelier. Part of it is technical, having a good website set up for live multimedia feedback so even people not physically there can follow along and contribute ideas. But the really critical change is structural. The events need to be designed to actively encourage deep community engagement during the event itself. By building in ways for attendees to actually assign themselves project tasks right then and there, and crucially, doing those tasks could earn the attendee back their entrance fee, maybe in Flovans or Flov hours. So you're essentially getting paid for contributing real work during the gathering.
Ah, turning attendees into collaborators on the spot.
Precisely. It shifts the dynamic away from that passive presenter audience thing towards a much more productive, decentralized working session.
Okay, let's try and wrap this up. We've covered a lot of ground today on this Flov.org material economy. It's clearly a really idealistic, fascinating blend of psychology, tech, and generosity. And it seems like its success doesn't just hinge on clever contracts or clauses, but really on building that unmaterial relational affinity, that deep trust, and using these designed karmic or social incentives to encourage good behavior.
Yeah, and if you connect it back to their overall strategy, the platform is explicitly betting on dissuading conflict. How? By making the platform itself, the community, so valuable that you don't want to risk losing access to it. If you, the user, mess up, violate a trust, ignore a wish, act unreliably, the main consequence isn't necessarily legal, it's losing the ability to borrow, lend, or participate fully in the future. Access becomes the leverage.